So just level setting some expectations. This is a deep dive session. We're gonna definitely talk about hardware and hardware specifics and the buildup of the solution. This is not a BI solution, a BI talk. So if you want to talk about BI or Power Pivot and things like that, this is not the session. This is an infrastructure session. Okay, we'll probably start up. We've got about another 2 minutes before we start up. When do we start? We're good? Okay. All righty. So we've got quite a number of slides. And we've got, 60 minutes to cover it all. And hopefully you won't hear the lightsaber, kind of feedback on the mic. Okay, so my name is Danny Tams. I'm the managing architect for the Appliance Center of Excellence. So our team work directly with engineering in effectively rolling out appliances around the world. So we are a worldwide organization as part of Microsoft Services, but effectively funded by the different program groups within Microsoft. So this session is SQL Server Database Private Cloud, and this is based on the database consolidation solution reference architecture. So it's a bit of a tongue twister. This is a white paper that we've put out in conjunction with HP. We've worked pretty much over the past year and a half, proven the architecture, released this as an appliance, and then gone through and released this as a reference architecture, effectively giving out the recipe of how we've gone through and built this from a software and hardware perspective. So the objectives of this session, what you're going to walk away with after being here in this session, is really the benefits. Firstly, the benefits that the private cloud can provide, specifically for databases. Understanding the reference architecture componentry, and this is going down back to the hardware, the software, how it's all laid out. Feel free to ask questions depending on how we go as far as the session. And how many slides we've got to go. I might defer some questions till the end, but I'm more than happy to sit back and take all the questions. I can talk about DBC for the next 48 hours straight. So my team has been running projects and running this effectively for the past year and a half. So we're going to go down and drill into the components. And then finally understand what is available as far as tools and how you would move forward in a consolidation type project, okay? Consolidation projects can easily run for 1 to 2 years. Consolidation is not trivial. There's a lot of things to think about. And even when you're starting to size some of these solutions to try and understand how many racks do I need, what kind of footprint, what's the cost of ownership, power consumption, weight, all that kind of stuff. You can spend many weeks and months actually making these calculations alone. Customers have told us they've spent easily up to 12 months trying to ascertain the performance characteristics of different SANs and different infrastructures in order to put a total solution together, effectively spending millions of dollars in the process. And I'll talk a little bit more about that and some experiences that we've had from customers around the world. I spent a lot of my time traveling around and meeting with customers and architecture teams, and they routinely, the whole point is to understand some of the pain points. One of the things that they tell us is obviously it costs a lot of money to go through all these different permutations and combinations of software and hardware and making a total solution out of it. So what we're going to cover is the reference architecture specifically that Microsoft and HP have put together. And yes, it is based on HP hardware. Okay, we've produced this as a white paper, and you can download this, read it. It's about a 50, 60-page document. It goes through the recipe of how we've put it together, some aspects of what you're expecting to get out of it as far as IOPS are concerned, and it's actually written in the paper as far as the number of IOPS that you can expect. Very few times you can get a solution that encompasses the recipe and how you build it, plus the guarantees that you're going to be able to get this many IOPS out of the solution at the end of it. Right? We know this because we've built it, we've tested it, we've scaled it out to numerous racks, and this is part of the talk. So we're also going to go into the component drill down. The solution also encompasses high availability as well as performance. And the components of this architecture, everything from networking to storage, and how we've put it together in some system center aspects, and how the Hyper-V is configured, and so on and so forth. So finally, achieving high availability and the metering and chargeback. As part of this reference architecture solution is also doing metering and chargeback on different for different workloads. So to say that workload XYZ belongs to ABC business unit, and the other infrastructure belongs to a different business unit. Being able to produce reports and produce graphs and understand the usage patterns, being able to do chargeback to different business units should you wish to do that. All of this is effectively built in to the solution. So here's the address that you can download the white paper. You know, copy the link. You're going to get the slides at the end of this TechEd presentation conference. So have a look at that, and it makes good reading. I mean, we're going to try and cover as much as possible with regards to this white paper in this session, but obviously a one-hour session is not really going to do it justice. So I'd strongly recommend that if you're interested in consolidation, you go through this paper. So where are we now? In most organizations that we've spoken to try to ascertain where they are, what they want to do as far as consolidation, what we find is that they have numerous versions of SQL Server, numerous versions of different hardware floating around. A, it could be from different vendors. B, it could be from different generations. You know, hardware that may be, a lot of it, you know, 3 up to 4 up to 5 years old. We've even talked to some government departments in other countries that have hardware close to pushing 10 years. Wow. It's like belongs in the Smithsonian. What are you still doing running this stuff? Where do you find the people to be able to manage this? How do you deal with security? You know, but anyway, so as you can see, the lady behind me here about to tear her hair out, you know, trying to figure out all the different network spaghetti. Over time, these become inefficient systems simply because there's so much different, so much change, so many different disparities between systems that it becomes hard to manage. You can't get a single view over the entire infrastructure. You don't know where you are at different patch levels. You don't know where you are as far as the different firmware that you have on each machine. The network infrastructure is clumsy. It's hard to upgrade. You can't slice and dice. High availability. In a lot of these older systems, there's single processor, single machine kind of configurations. So the other thing, of course, is the costs. The costs of managing and running all this infrastructure becomes huge. The watt, if you like, the watt per clock cycle ratio on older hardware means that it's a lot more expensive per clock cycle to drive older hardware than current generation hardware. So where we're going right now is combinations of software and hardware to be able to solve these business problems. So NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the U.S., basically put together a loose set of definitions about what is a private cloud or what you should expect from a private cloud. So effectively, for resource pooling, to be able to quarantine and carve out resources or groups of resources, memory, disk, CPUs, to be able to allocate that to different requirements. Like I want to run a certain business unit, wants to run a small data warehouse, or want to run a small OLTP application. I want to be able to then also deploy this quickly. When we talk to customers, they're very proud when they tell us, you know, we can deploy new infrastructure in under a week. Okay, and they're very happy about that because it took them from what it was before, maybe 10 weeks, down to 1 week, right? That's awesome. Well, with this solution, we're talking about deploying infrastructure in 5 minutes. That's what we're talking about. That's orders of magnitude improvement. And being able to bring that deployment closer to the people who need it. Now, in order to get some new infrastructure deployed, you have to go through the process of filling out all the paperwork, and that goes and you go through the approvals process, and someone rubber stamps it, then you order the hardware, and someone has to build it, and then it goes to the DBAs. That's the part that you care about, and they have to install SQL Server on it, install it as per the SOE, configure it appropriately. If you need reporting services, slap that down and get it all working. So what we're talking about, based on templates and based on setting up the appropriate users, you can then go through and deploy based on templates in minutes. So you say, I want this kind of configuration, a small, medium, or a large kind of configuration for SQL Server and reporting services, press the button, and the system starts building in the background. Now, it doesn't mean that you bypass all the workflows, right? There's still workflow built into it to have the appropriate approvals process. And in most organizations, the IT department is still going to be the ones pressing the actual buttons to actually do the deployment of the of this new infrastructure. But it means that now that the time has been shortened dramatically. Finally, the control and customization, which is all about being able to do chargeback, being able to understand where your usage patterns are, being able to understand how much memory does a certain business group occupy. You know, right now, if you go to your infrastructure and you say, okay, business group XYZ, how much memory across all the different machines are they occupying? If we were to do chargeback, how much disk space, how much compute capacity are they occupying if we were going to do a chargeback model? That's very, very challenging. You know, it can take months to come up with this. On the reference architecture built the appropriate way, you can get this every single day. And every hour, the process goes through and does all the accounting. So the reference architecture, and this is a bit of a long tongue twister, the Microsoft Hewlett-Packard DBC reference architecture solution here, bit of a tongue twister, let's call it DBC from now on, effectively comes factory pre-built. So there are processes from HP. It's called the process that you need to talk to your HP buddies about. It's called Factory Express. We've already worked with Microsoft to put together the recipe. So by the time it hits your loading dock, it's already built as far as the hardware is concerned. Already cabled up. There's a science even right down to the way that you cable this thing. So then there's consulting and support to be able to go through and deploy this. You could deploy it in a couple of weeks, and you're up and running, and then your voyage of consolidation will begin effectively, rather than spending several months up to a year to actually build the infrastructure before you do your first consolidation, your first real consolidation. It's optimized. It's tuned specifically for a SQL Server workload. For a SQL Server workload, as we spoke about before, what do you need? You need a lot of I.O. And you need guaranteed I/O. And not sporadic I/O, like today performs well. Tomorrow, run the same query, it performs really badly. Why is that? Right? If you're on a lot of the shared infrastructure that many people are on, you know, some other guy's trying to do a backup, or some other team is trying to do a different type of a workload on it, and now you have one workload impacting another workload. You also have situations of security. So in a large environment with thousands of servers, sure, I know everyone's got AD. I get that. But now, you know, what happens if a certain user doesn't need access to this resource anymore? Or you want to have quarantined boundaries between one application and another application. Say one application is an insecure application where the users routinely use the SA password in order to get in. You start to do instance stacking and you start to put all this together. Well, now you've got to hand out the SA password. But what happens to all of the other infrastructure that happens to be running on that server? You can't hand out the SA password. Now you have political problems. So now, also from an agility perspective, provision SQL Server and SQL Server infrastructure on demand as required, metering and chargeback. Right here you'll see it's built on Windows Server. I call it out now 2008 R2, but this is also possible on Windows Server 2012. Okay. Also for SQL Server, this has already been certified for SQL Server 2012. Based, of course, on the combination of HP and Microsoft. So how, if I step back and pull back a little bit, how did we get to these reference architectures? What do they all mean? Where is Microsoft going? So years ago, Microsoft started going down the path of reference architectures as one of the splits off the mainstream. So we've had box product as we know and love it today, and for many years this will continue. You go to the shop, you buy the software, you install it. But there's also the cloud, which is Azure and SQL Azure. That's the other branch, the pillar of the data space. And also appliances and reference architectures. So we first started with appliances easily about reference architectures and appliances easily about 3-4 years ago now. First, it was the fast-track reference architectures. How to build a data warehouse. Basically, we provide you the recipe from a number of different vendors, and it comes pre-configured, pre-installed, and it's certified to run a certain number of IOPS, so that when you load it up with your data warehousing workload, you're not going to be sitting there scratching your head trying to figure out why SQL Server is running at 5% CPU utilization, and you're going flat out and not getting anywhere fast. So then we've grown this up right up to the appliance, which is Parallel Data Warehouse. We've got a session that talks about it tomorrow. I think it's around about the 8 o'clock in the morning, so it depends, you know, how you feel after the party this evening. And so you'll learn a lot more about Parallel Data Warehouse, how it scales out. And so this session is about the DBC reference architecture, which actually comes from an appliance. We liberated it just from an appliance. We are promoting or giving out the actual recipe. Gives a little bit more flexibility in some cases, because as an appliance, you can't go through and modify the hardware stack. You can't go through and modify the software stack. As a reference architecture, the reference architecture provides you the guide. Here's the straight line. If you want to deviate from that, doing that at your own risk, because you have certain requirements within your business. You need to do it, for example, with Dell hardware or with IBM hardware or whatever it is your hardware vendor is. Then that's fine. You know kind of the vision and the rule that we've been following as far as building this. You might be able to make some changes there. Again, you're doing that. You're taking full control and full responsibility for that. Now, many times in doing sessions and talking with customers, there's at this point a bit of confusion. And it's like, you know, when we're talking to the HP guys, they tell us, you know, we've got virtual systems. We've got three different types, virtual system one, virtual system two. And you coming along, you're telling us about DBC. How does this thing fit together? You know, should we go with Microsoft? Should we go with another vendor? What do we do? So the main decision point here is what you're actually trying to virtualize. If you're trying to virtualize applications, the virtual system 1, 2, 3 from HP is a great solution, right? Why? You don't necessarily need that high amount of IOPS. You'll see in these kinds of solutions here that it's fairly compute-centric. In this case, they're using a C7000 blade center chassis. Okay, I'm kind of jumping into the hardware here. And here we're using the C3000 blade center chassis, right? And why is that? It's more compute, a whole lot more compute-intensive rather than I/O-intensive. So the database consolidation solution is really based on very fast I/O throughput to be able to sustain the I/O workloads. You know, even before we were talking about consolidation for SQL Server, for many years, even before, long before we had this solution, I was even one of the guys saying, well, you shouldn't really consolidate SQL Server. And there's a reason for that. It's because the hardware could not sustain the transaction throughput. And you used to have situations, now you're putting all your eggs in one basket, right? And you're not able to drive the I/O throughput. Great, you've got this, lots of memory, lots of CPU, and the CPU is being driven at 5 or 10%. And effectively, you can't get the return on investment that you've made in those CPUs. And as we know, chips these days are not cheap. Enterprise chips, talking $5,000, $6,000 a pop. So with this solution, it's built again on a fast-track reference architectures and the principles, which is to balance the I/O with the compute power. So if you read some of the data warehousing reference architectures and how we come up with the numbers for that, it's to essentially say, here is the throughput that you are expecting to get, or you can push through a chip, and how do you ensure that you have enough I/O to be able to maximize that? Well, based on these kinds of principles, be able to scale this out and be able to also support consolidation-type workloads where you don't have a stall in the compute power because your I/O can't support it. As you can see, there's quite a lot of disks here, and we'll talk about the details of how it's all set up and the software, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole idea is being able to take this solution from a baby solution and grow it up right up to 10 racks, all managed as a single solution. Be able to log into the System Center console, whether you have a one-rack solution, a half-rack solution, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 10 racks, which is a pod, and they're easily connected up together. So you want to start this year with a single rack? That's great. Next year, you want to add another rack? That's fine, too. You don't have to buy everything up front. And we've done all the testing ahead of time to prove that this will actually work. Very significant savings as far as both from a manageability perspective. Why? Because now you're managing by exception rather than managing by coming in every morning and looking at all the logs. Or heaven forbid, the other option is you kind of sit around the phone and make sure that the phone line works. And you're waiting for the first call and really being in reactive mode, and you find out that there's a problem when the phone rings. Right? That is not a good place to be. So this enables you to move forward and be able to take a little bit more proactive approach. The unique value proposition that the reference architecture provides is a faster time to build. Normally, you've got to go through and design the solution. You might go through an RFP, check out all the different vendors, everything from HP to IBM to Fujitsu, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. See what solutions, and all the different vendors have lots of different solutions in this space. Even if you're picking one or two different vendors within your organization, there's still a lot of different options. Do you go blade infrastructure? Do you go disparate servers? How do you do high availability? Is it a cluster? How do you do clustering? How do you do disaster recovery? All these kinds of factors. How do you plug this thing into your normal, into your switch? So we've spent easily, you know, hundreds of man years in order to put this solution together. So the DBC reference architecture effectively means that you buy a pre-assembled solution. it comes, there's a process of integrating this with your network, and you're off and running, and you start consolidating. And that's where the real fun begins, right? To start building the case, to start bringing across all the infrastructure. How do you then begin to consolidate? Intricacies of workload partitioning, but it gives you the managed infrastructure that you can use. The point is here, deploy with confidence. We've done all the homework and all the research to be able to solve these kinds of problems ahead of time so that you don't have to solve these problems either during your design phase or especially in production of how you can go through and measure the certain types of workloads or how you do partitioning between workloads, etc. All of this is based on System Center, Operations Manager, and Virtual Machine Manager, and the various tools, and put together and backed up by the Data Protection Manager. So we talked about scale and how you can scale. You can go from 1 to 200 virtual machines or virtual workloads right up to thousands. In the 10-rack configuration, you can do 2,000 virtual workloads. Now, first question I usually get at this stage is, okay, where'd you get the number 200 or the number 100 virtual workloads for a half-rack base configuration? Okay, well, there's math behind that on how we did that, and we're going to talk about these the different sizes of the buckets and how you can do some cost attribution and how you can come up with the different measurements and the sizes. So we did calculations based on a large Microsoft consolidation where we consolidated 11,000 or so servers, saving us at the end many millions of dollars every year. And we've also done this with a number of customers. From an energy perspective, many, many times I talk to customers and they tell me our biggest problem is our outsourcer owns and manages the data center. We don't have enough power to be able to power up more machines. You know, this will certainly reduce the amount of power consumption that you, A, have to pay for, and B, will free up your data center for other things that you need to run with it. One of the things I need to pull back here and tell you about is specifically with DBC, it's not necessarily about having one platform to consolidate absolutely everything. There are limits for this. This is essentially a consolidation project, is a cost minimization project. And in doing so, you want to be able to mop up all the rats and mice kind of servers that have been out there for a long period of time, put them into an environment and de-risk them. If you have a situation where you have, you know, even SQL Server 2000 or 2005, old operating systems like 2003, why? Because that's what the software vendor for the application first stipulated. Now you've got a problem. You can't upgrade it. You can't patch it. If you touch it, you now have issues with the support of the application and so on and so forth. You can bring all this infrastructure in within a virtualized environment, and now upgrading this becomes a lot easier. You want to do UAT on this? You can do that. However, this is not meant to consolidate your largest of the large systems. So I'm not recommending this for anything over, you know, a database size of a terabyte. In fact, we typically recommend that your largest kind of workloads are around the 400, maybe 500 gigabytes in size. If you want to do a large enterprise data warehouse, terabytes, petabytes, et cetera, this is not the solution for you. If you want to host, for example, a large SAP implementation, you know, sure, you might be able to host the basis application service, but this is not to host, you know, a 20 terabyte SAP system. This is to be able to pick up the hundreds, potentially thousands of servers that might be out there and bring them into a managed environment. So when we did these calculations on floor space and cooling, there's actually spreadsheets that are available. You can download these. I know that the hardware vendors also have this. we calculated these are the kind of savings that we were able to get. And in the administration space, it doesn't mean that the admins kind of miraculously go away. No, the skill set changes because now, as admins, you're not managing just SQL Server. You're managing the solution, both from understanding if you have a failure somewhere, or blade fails, or a hard disk fails, right up to the entire stack, which is getting alerts from SQL Server if there's a problem, et cetera, et cetera. So, the reference architecture. Let's dig a little bit deeper now. We've covered the basics, the benefits, et cetera, and so we get into the meat and potatoes now. So in the base configuration, it starts off as a half rack. You get six D2700 disk racks and a two P2000s. It's the HP C3000 disk, Blade Center configuration. The whole idea behind this, you'll notice that it's not, and customers have told us, this is not enterprise-grade SAN infrastructure. Yeah, okay. That's fine. It doesn't need to be a really expensive SAN. This will guarantee you the IOPS that you need. And think of it as a Lego block. This is the base configuration of a Lego block. So if you want to extend or you need a second Lego block, you don't take the Lego block and stretch it. You get an extra one. And you basically build it up as far as Lego blocks is concerned. So this is the base configuration. Now, of course, the costs, obviously you get some network switches and the full rack. This will also extend to a full rack capacity where you get you fully populate the Blade Center chassis plus the extra switches on the top. Obviously, the cost difference between this and this is like kind of 60% of the total cost as opposed to obviously 100% total cost. The reason for that is because obviously in a half rack you still need the extra switches to provide you with the high availability that's built into the solution. So this will guarantee 60,000 IOPS, be able to provide you with the high availability to failover workloads under the covers and give you the infrastructure stability and the confidence that you need. Under the covers, we're running effectively 400 spindles, 57 terabytes of raw space, 2 terabytes of memory. This is a large machine to be able to run workloads. This is not Blade Center infrastructure of 5 years ago that was, quite small. Each particular blade has got 256 gigs of memory. It's been specifically designed based on Blade Center's, yes, commodity hardware, but there is configuration under the covers for the software that's running all this. Special configuration, for example, to get the virtual connects working appropriately so you can get the maximum throughput. There's 40 gigabit of connection back to the customer network to be able to do I/O. Under the covers, the whole system is running using iSCSI. This is how do you configure all the software to be able to work with this? All this has essentially been done in the recipes between HP and Microsoft. So scale out, this is our scale out story. Being able to start off with a half rack configuration, add extra racks or half racks on an as required basis, where the storage and the compute power also follows from a rack to a rack to a rack. And it's true, this is all contained when you are moving across your workloads from your existing compute infrastructure connected to a SAN, you not only retire your computational power, but you're also retiring your SAN. Why? Because, quite frankly, your SAN infrastructure, or a lot of the SAN infrastructure, unless you spend millions and millions of dollars on it, and you've got more than one HBA per server, you're not getting the I/O throughput that you need unless you've specifically tested it. So many times we hear from customers, okay, we've spent millions of dollars. We can't get rid of the SAN. What are we going to do with it? So you can use it as a backup device. There's specific mechanisms that you can dump out data from this and use back it up to SAN. Spindles and the way spindles and technology is going moving forward is that spindles are going to be used as backup devices. Eventually, a lot of infrastructure is going to solid state. So, come on. Okay, let's talk about the software stack now and how that works and how that's effectively put together. At the lowest levels, it's System Center Operations Manager sitting on top of Windows Server, obviously, and Hyper-V, and the Insight Control tools and software. This is hooks directly into the hardware, so if there is a failure or a problem, or you want to upgrade the firmware, there's a process called OneTouch to be able to do all the upgrades and the management. If there's a problem, it bubbles the error up. It's very easy. You pick up the phone, you say, hey, I've got a broken hard drive, or you can even configure that. HP can come and configure that so it all can do some dial backs. From a higher level of management, you've got Virtual Machine Manager and the Operations Manager. Effectively, you now are able to manage by exception. You're not sitting there looking at logs on several hundred SQL servers every day. You are consolidating all of this infrastructure. You are consolidating all of the alerts that you're able to get out of the solution into one console that someone can go through, log in. You can set up various templates for different operation styles. So one user wants to see all of the different servers as red or yellow or green. A different user wants to see reports and exceptions, and you drill into things. At a higher level, it's obviously the OS monitoring of the guests and the hosts, plus being able to use the configuration manager. So you get the whole System Center stack. When you deploy this reference architecture. All this is effectively protected by the Data Protection Manager software. Now, for this, I can understand that most customers have their own backup tools and their own backup software that's mandated. If you don't want to use Data Protection Manager, you can use your own tools. As long as they're able to operate in the same way as Data Protection Manager, using volume shadow copy and some of the other mechanisms that are under the covers. Also, from an antivirus perspective, there's certain, you have to make sure that the antivirus tools that you deploy on this have to be certified for Windows Server. I know a lot of vendors say they are. You need to check that actual certification. And it needs specifically to be tested against clusters. I've seen personal experience here. I've seen many, many blue screens from issues where antivirus software had not been certified or had not been tested against the data center edition or clustering, etc. So, a bit more. This is the product stack that you get in detail with, obviously, one of the other things is it's called Opalis or the Orchestrator. Now, you're not forced to use this, obviously. We've also provided the self-service portal. The self-service portal provides the workflow to be able to say, I want to deploy new infrastructure. A, what infrastructure can I deploy? So the first thing is you start quarantining sections of the solution to say, okay, this department will now pre-acquire X number of processors out of the total amount of processors that the host can provide, this much disk, this much memory, and out of that start carving off individual workloads that they want to deploy based on the templates. So this is part of the configuration that's actually done post-acquisition. Opalis and the Orchestrator provides an even deeper workflow. If, for example, the workflow that we provide straight out of the box does not cut it for whatever reason, because you have, I don't know, multiple levels of approvals, then you can design your own infrastructure approvals process or orchestration. For example, you might need to, you can't assign IP addresses automatically or MAC addresses automatically. You've got to go to another team to assign an IP address and a MAC address. You have to go to yet another team to assign a machine name. Well, the orchestrator tool can basically help you do that, provides the workflow to be able to manage this. Now, from a storage perspective, how does it work? In a half-rack configuration, effectively there's dual 10 gigabit switches, for redundancy. There's dual virtual connect ports. These are software-based ports, and internally these are like switches, where you can carve out how much network I/O throughput you want versus, you know, 2 gigabit or 8 gigabit or 1 gigabit, and different switches and multiple networks are used in order to both maintain the solution as well as the iSCSI configurations to be able to do the storage for the solution. And we are using the P2000 enclosure. Under the covers, this has dual memory paths, RAID controllers, so if there's a failure, you don't have a problem. We can lose an entire disk cabinet. We can lose up to 25 drives before you lose any data. Okay, you're not expected to lose 25 drives in one day. So there's a lot of redundancy built into this. As you start to scale out from a half rack to a full rack, it's just bolting in the new infrastructure and making the appropriate connections. The software to manage the solution is already part of the half rack solution. So you don't need any extra software in order to manage this. So the system center infrastructure, and we'll talk about that, how the infrastructure is laid out on the blades, and how you can even move the management infrastructure between the different parts of the solution. So, some common usage scenarios. As we talked about, this reference architecture will enable you to embark upon a consolidation project far faster, get you on the ship, for example. The whole idea is that you're going to be able to employ physical to virtual migrations that will also work against other virtualization technologies, VMware, Citrix, etc. Also, you can follow the process. You type in the credentials. To virtualize something is a 5-minute process. But to go through and take this into production, and this is from a consulting process, this is not a product thing, you know, there's obviously a large number of steps. You need to go through and test it. You go through UAT, so you might make a copy of this running server. You then put it through your own UAT testing processes to certify it and validate it, that A, the users are happy to continue running in this fashion. And then finally, you get the approvals and the sign-offs, and you do the internal education, and you talk to the business, and so on and so forth, and you say, okay, we are ready to go and put it into production. So lots of physical to virtual migrations. You can also, as we discussed before, create new infrastructure very, very rapidly by employing the templates that are already part of the reference architecture. So moving forward, a couple more slides. So big difference here between the other virtual systems, the compute capacity is based on the C3000 enclosure. Initially you get 4 blades. In the full rack you get 8 blades under the covers. Each one of those has got 256 gigabytes of RAM, giving you a total capacity of 2 terabytes. That's a lot of cache. That's a lot of work that you can do. You can host a lot of virtual machines in that infrastructure. So From the disk subsystem under the covers, how does that look like? The iSCSI configuration is that one P2000 is connected to three JBODs effectively, or D2700 disk subsystems. You can lose any one of those connections in the way that it's set up. Fully formatted, it's 22 terabytes of disk space. And this forms the basic building block of the storage. And from this point on, it's effectively just multiplied out. From a half rack, you get two of these. In a full rack, you get four of these. And as you go through, you get four of these per individual rack as you scale out. And again, we're using mirroring under the covers in order to provide the high availability at the disk subsystem level. And we'll go through even right down to how the LUNs are actually configured. On a cabling perspective for the iSCSI storage, again, using the best practices from HP and from Microsoft on how to go through and configure this. So that if you lose a cable, as is very often the case, you don't lose the iSCSI connectivity between the different enclosures. So again, high availability from a cabling perspective, high availability from a disk subsystem perspective. You can see dual supplies, and I'm not going to drill down too much into the HP hardware, but you get my picture. From a networking perspective, we use a number of different switches. Again, for the management, we're routinely through POCs and customer workshops. We load up this solution to 100% capacity and tell the customer, okay, walk up to the infrastructure and start pulling the plug on the network switch. And let's see what happens, okay? How many packets are we losing? Do we lose any connections? What happens to the virtual workloads that are running on this? Do we have any downtime? So you can disable the network and there's no downtime. You're not losing packets. Again, all this has been tested in the factory, and you get all this as part of the recipe. The iSCSI storage traffic, again, same thing. You say, okay, disable and pull the plug on the iSCSI switch, or rip out some of the connections on the back of the machine to the blade center, or disable various parts of the network, even right down to the power. So go to the power configuration and disconnect a couple of the cables. And let's see what happens. So they're very happy to know that all the workloads basically work together without any problems. You can take out, and we routinely do, halfway through when an entire machine is running, rip out, flick the little switch and rip out the entire blade while it's running. And let's see how long it takes to actually fail over the workloads to the remaining blade infrastructure. You know, failover times of typically sub 1 minute as far as downtime is concerned. Here is the virtual connect that I was talking about before. This is a software-based switch internally. And based on software configurations from HP and Microsoft, we've carved this out appropriately so you can get the maximum throughput back to your customer network. So this will plug in a double redundant way back to your customer core switches, maybe a Cisco 6000 or something like that that you might have in your data center. So you don't plug into an intermediate switch. This plugs in directly into the core switches. So here's where we want to now discuss the virtual workloads and the different size of these buckets. So when I say 200 workloads in a full rack, internally, we've tested this at 1,000 workloads. So we wanted to say, okay, well, we're telling our customers at 200, okay, where is the breaking point? We wanted to test it till you can't do any more. So we were able to get 1,000 virtual workloads running on a single rack configuration going at 100%. So in a small, medium, and large, we've carved this out because we went around both Microsoft and other customers and we say, okay, What kind of infrastructure do you routinely have? Remember, this is not about consolidating your this generation G7 or G8 servers or your current generation Dell servers or IBM servers that have 16 CPUs or 20 CPUs in them. This is taking the rats and mice that might have, for example, a one processor system sitting there doing nothing for a long time, or two processor system. If we do a comparison of the compute power of hardware of a few generations ago, one socket is worth one core today, right? Now, again, don't take it from me just because I happen to be standing up here and say, some guy at TechEd said, you know, there was one core equals one socket of a while ago. There's specific tools that you can download that we'll go through, and we'll talk about, called the MAP Toolkit, that will go and do an audit across all of your infrastructure and say, okay, you know, this machine runs at this gigahertz. This other machine, you know, has two CPUs, what configuration it is. So we went through on a large number of customers indeed these kinds of infrastructure inventories. And out of these, we saw that, you know, we discovered a huge number of single processor machines. Then finally up to four processors. So we bucketized this. So we saw that, you know, we've got on the small configuration about 50 IOPS is all you need, right up to 1600 IOPS for a large configuration. So putting all this together, how many can you have? Typically you have a mix of 128 small workloads, 48 medium workloads, and 16 large workloads based on, you know, best practices and what we've seen most customers have. Okay? It's possible that you might deviate in your environment. And again, you might get a higher density and you might get a lower density. But the MAP Toolkit will help you in order to scope this out and understand how many nodes you need under the covers in order to be able to support your unique workload, right? So this is a standardized kind of workload that we're talking about here. Okay? So how does this work from a software perspective? So as I mentioned before, the base configuration comes with four blades. Now, in order to make the fonts kind of big enough so we can see it, it kind of looks like all of the infrastructure of blade one is taken up by the virtual machines, which are the management infrastructure. That's hardly the case. It was just so that we can show the diagram. About 80 or 90% of the capacity of blade one is still available for user workloads. So just like in SQL Server, where the commands that you use in order to manage SQL Server are effectively SQL, as opposed, that's why it's called an RDBMS. Just like that, in the database consolidation RA, you have the infrastructure to manage the whole solution is virtualized itself. So you can log into this from outside the solution, from your desktop, manage this as a separate a machine, for example, running Virtual Machine Manager or Operations Manager. So you can have different teams, if you want to do it that way, logging in to the different parts of the infrastructure. The infrastructure itself, the management infrastructure, is also highly available. So if you have a failure, the infrastructure itself will also move across to the other blades. Under the covers, we also have, as I mentioned before, high availability at multiple levels. Each one of the blades, we have also installed an Active Directory. So this is its own Active Directory to manage the entire reference architecture, the entire solution. So if you happen to lose a number of blades or the connectivity back to Active AD, it has its own AD. So the security is not compromised. The failovers as far as the under-the-cover Hyper-V clusters, because in the base configuration you have a four-node cluster. In the extended full configuration of an entire rack, it's an eight-node cluster. And, of course, Active Directory is a requirement. So The rest of the infrastructure, the other blades, are essentially empty, waiting for custom workloads under the covers. So, as we've talked about, we have high availability built in from a both an AD perspective. There's redundancy. So on the HA perspective, there's base levels of VMs are made highly available. There's also, of course, benefits of going to Windows Server 2012, and I'm going to cover that too. Also, from a SQL Server perspective, you can set up, if for whatever reason you want to set up a cluster, you can do that on this infrastructure in a virtualized environment. So you set up virtual clusters. So even with SQL Server today, there are some use case scenarios where you really do want to set up a SQL Server cluster. Because if you want to go through and patch a SQL Server, well, that means when you're actually installing the patch or the service pack, well, you need downtime. Well, how do you normally do it? You have to then go through and fail it over to another node of the cluster and then be able to manage that if you really, really want to minimize the amount of downtime in your SQL Server cluster. And there are specific cases about this. You know, if you're running, for example, a stock exchange, you can't say, well, you know what, I need to kind of manage and, you know, upgrade the cluster or, you know, upgrade SQL Server. You know, can you suffer 5, 10 minutes or half an hour downtime? You can't do that. So there's still some cases where you really need a cluster. So now we do support virtualized clusters within this infrastructure. From a disaster recovery perspective, you know, you can now effectively you have two of these reference architectures, two half racks or two full racks or two multiple racks, or two racks on one side going to one rack on another side. It's purely customizable. What we have found is that, of course, when we ask a customer, do you want disaster recovery with this solution? The answer is automatically yes. We want everything to be both highly available and resilient as far as a disaster is concerned. So my next question is, okay, so what kind of network infrastructure have you got between your two data centers? Oh, we have, 256K connections. You're not going to be able, that's your biggest bottleneck. Your network infrastructure between the two data centers is a critical factor because we can provide the disaster recovery based on SQL Server technologies. Now, customers have asked us, why can't we build this into the hardware? Well, we've looked at many, many different hardware options. And either if we were to include hardware-based, like, for example, EMC has SRDF or HA for HP or many different vendors, then effectively this would not be a consolidation reference architecture. This would be a highly available or a disaster recovery solution because of the cost of implementing disaster recovery is 2 or 3 times the cost of this reference architecture solution, hardware, software put together. So there are a number of third-party host-based clustering DR solutions if you want to implement those. Typically, we always recommend going with database mirroring. Database mirroring can provide very low latency failovers between different sites. Routinely, we find after talking with customers in consolidation projects, this is what I've personally found. And also my colleagues, there's about 15 of us in our team. Easily, you can turn off easily between 10 and 15% of all the workloads. You have to find out which ones they are, but we find that about 10 to 15% of all the workloads, say in large government departments or in banks, have been lost in time. At some point in the past, this infrastructure was very important, used for a project. The guy who ordered it and was running it and managed it has moved on, left the company. The server's still there, kind of whirring in the background, occupying, taking up power. Everyone's forgotten about it. Who knows about this server? I don't know. Well, this other guy, he knows. So a lot of the times, 10%, you can just turn it off. Then we also have the discussion about high availability and disaster recovery. In most cases, we find that customers say, well, we don't really need high availability for this stuff anyway. Realistically, do we need, you know, 1 minute failover time for a server that's part of a development team that's used at once every 6 months? Typically not. Even less for disaster recovery. So saying, okay, my entire data center now has gone underwater or is offline. This solution is so mission critical that I want it to automatically be able to fail over to my other data center. We typically find for these kinds of workloads that a very, very small percentage of these solutions need disaster recovery. Now, it's possible that in your environment, things might be different. But it's worth having these kinds of discussions. So this is, again, how we've connected this to the customer core switch. Now, these might, to some people, seem like trivialities of the hardware or the implementation. But we're using link aggregation in order to be able to do that. The customer, obviously, would have two core switches per data center in order to have the redundancy. So we also maintain this redundancy connecting to the core infrastructure. Again, we've configured the network interfaces here and here to be able to go through and maximize the I/O throughput so that the connectivity loss is minimized, as well as the performance is maximized. So in all of this infrastructure, if you wanted to patch the infrastructure, so you can patch the networks, network switches with no downtime. You can patch and upgrade firmware and software and management software of the chassis with no downtime. The only downtime that you might need, and this is to upgrade the firmware on the blades themselves. And again, that causes a reboot. In that configuration, the workload that's running on top on that particular blade that gets rebooted can either automatically fail over to the other remaining blades, or you can migrate that, effectively doing a live migration before you upgrade the firmware and reboot that particular portion of the solution, and therefore you have no downtime. So there's different ways. From a network's perspective, right up from a software to a hardware, or rather from a hardware to a software perspective, how it works. Of course, yes, we have our connections. These are doubly linked on through the virtual connect, again, using software. Connected to teaming instances. Again, we're now starting to touch the software configurations and the configurations of the drivers. And connecting to the Hyper-V virtual switches. You'll see we have a backup network and a production network. So when we do a backup, we're not impacting the production network throughput. All this connects to multiple networks in the actual virtual machines themselves. So you'll see in the infrastructure, you'll have a management network or a production network and a backup network to be able to back up your entire infrastructure. And again, when you roll this out in templates, there's multiple virtual networks within each particular template to be able to roll it out. From a performance testing perspective, we've gone through and tested all of this configuration, and these are the number of IOPS in a purely random fashion. So when we're testing this, we tested a random I/O, 100% random I/O disk load, and in a 60% read, 40% write configuration. And in this configuration, we've proven that we are able to get, well, slightly over 30,000 IOPS in a half rack and slightly over 60,000 IOPS in a full rack configuration. With this kind of price point, as far as the hardware software is concerned, there's no other solution really in the industry that would give you this kind of sustained I/O throughput. We're not using caching here. This is what the system can sustain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with no downtime. Right? There, I know that there's other caching accelerators and that people can purchase, and that's great as long as you don't run out of cache and then you start hitting the disks. So again, we're using a configuration that is tried and true between HP and Microsoft as the base building blocks for carving out the solution. Now, here's some more specs about the number of drives and things like that. I'm sure you can read all that a little bit later on. In a formatted capacity on a per rack basis, the thing to understand is you get 27 terabytes of formatted capacity. Again, we're recommending that your workload doesn't really exceed 400 or 500 gigabytes in size, because you're consolidating certain types of workload. Now, on the virtual connect design, this is how we can show this is the 40 gigabytes of I/O that we get through to the customer's network. There's mezzanine cards and the way the blades are configured under the covers in order to be able to provide this. This is firmware configuration, things that you don't normally get when you get the hardware straight out of the box. There is a lot of extra customization and configuration as per the reference architecture in order to get this configuration right here. If you are a virtual connect kind of guy, and you've looked at your own hardware, you know, there's like pages and pages of configuration in order to be able to set it up this way. So from a disk perspective, how we've set it up is we've gone through, we've got the disks that are mirrored, so you can lose an entire shelf of disks and have no downtime whatsoever. In fact, we've produced videos where we run a certain workload and we sit there ripping out hard drives and show the performance monitor that there's no degradation in the transaction throughput. Here's some effectively some screenshots. I'd love to bring a DBC RA here in a rack and kind of show it to you, but customs wouldn't let us do that. So some pictures under the covers. It is using Hyper-V in a clustered configuration in order to show the disks. These are the clustered shared volumes. 10 terabytes of total disk space in a half rack configuration. The workloads themselves are services in their own right, so therefore they're able to fail across the 4 or 8 node cluster to be able to provide the high availability. And again, we have multiple networks. The cluster nodes are the Heartbeat network is dual. We have dual iSCSI configurations as far as networking is concerned. Again, multiple layers of high availability. So, if you've loved all this, basically, as far as an RA based on Windows Server 2008, you're going to love it even more on 2012. Getting the ability, you can upgrade this or build this out using Windows Server 2012. The limitations, and let's face it, on Windows Server 2008, there were some limitations, 4 cores or 4 virtual CPUs per Hyper-V. That all goes away. 64 logical procs per VM, 1 terabyte of memory, should you wish to do that. Okay, you're now hitting the limitations of the hardware versus 64 gigabytes of what it used to be. Non-clustered live migration, so there might be some differences. You don't need to cluster anymore. They can be in disparate machines. You can now also go through and apply NUMA configurations right down from the hardware perspective, right down to the virtual machine. NUMA is really good if you're starting to build your own really high-throughput performing solutions. As far as transaction throughput rate, really small transactions, NUMA can really help you because you can bind your TCP/IP connections to specific NUMA nodes. Now you can do that even in a virtualization environment. In a Hyper-V environment, we've also proved that we can get And there's another talk about this. 1 million IOPS per in a specific VM. You know, there's a white paper on it. There's a presentation on this. This is not smoke and mirrors. You can get the hardware. You can test it yourself. 1 million IOPS in a Hyper-V environment. Okay, so Hyper-V and virtualization is really the way that the way of the future and where things are going. Now, the Map Toolkit. I'd recommend that you download the Map Toolkit from the web. It's a free tool. One of the things that it does is got specific reports into it. Whoops, let's go back. It's got specific reports in there that will automatically pre-size an environment of how many racks you need and how many nodes you need as far as the reference architecture. So you would run this across in your environment. It would do an inventory. Out of this, calculate the amount of CPU that's required. It can cut down the amount of time that's required in order to do this this inventory from months down to potentially days or weeks. Because we recommend, there's some best practices where we recommend you run the Map Toolkit for a period of 3, maybe even up to 4 weeks. You want to capture and continue capturing information during a busy period, because during that time it can capture I/O performance information, CPU performance information, and then accurately size the size of the virtual machine container from a small or medium and a large of what you need. And of course, there's going to be cases, this is where the human intervention comes in, where the software says, you know what, according to what you've configured, this is larger than a large. Okay, so you might have a virtual machine or a server that's got a terabyte of disk. Well, that terabyte of disk is not going to fit in 500 gig or 400 gig. So then there is a bit of a manual intervention in order to figure out, do I really need this much disk space? Can I cut it down? And that's where the human intervention comes in. But you're not doing activities which is just grunt work, gathering information. It coalesces all this information back into a database, and you are now able to query it. So that's kind of like a very, very high-level discussion on Map Toolkit. The provisioning portal, this is the self-service portal that we were talking about before. Again, it's a tool where you can now go through and you can configure and carve out resources on this reference architecture, be able to assign different users who have the authority to now create virtual workloads and deploy SQL Server in different configurations as per templates. You can say, I want to deploy 10 SQL Servers in this configuration. You press the button, and off you go. The metering and chargeback is the reports that are built in to be able to calculate and give you on a daily basis the usage and the metering of network I/O, disk I/O, CPU, and so on and so forth. From a support perspective, in the past, we really recommended Premier Mission Critical, or it was essentially a requirement. With the reference architecture, you are now able to get support using Premier support, and of course, the different offerings from HP as well. Talk to your HP guys for that. From a Microsoft perspective, Premier support will be able to give you support 24/7. I know many of you, if you're coming to this event, probably already have Premier support, so I'm not going to dwell on that. We're pretty much at the end of the session right here. Go on. So I want to thank you all for coming, and I'll stick around if you have questions. Happy to talk about this and drill into any technical details and questions that you might have.